Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Rest is History. Dominic Sandbrook here. Now, after the death of Mikhail Gorbachev a couple of days ago, quite a few of our listeners have been on Twitter and email and asking us if we would do a special bonus episode on Gorbachev, on the fall of the Soviet Union, and his legacy and his meaning in Russia today. Well, we have tremendous news for those people and for any of our newer listeners. The truth is we have already done a whole mini-series about Mikhail Gorbachev, about Boris Yeltsin, the fall of the USSR, and the subsequent rise of Vladimir Putin and how that led to the war in Ukraine. So that was 4 episodes, and we released them a while ago. And to make things easier, what we've done is we've stitched together the first 2 episodes into a longer special, and that looks at the world in which Gorbachev became the General Secretary of the Soviet Union, his early life, his experiences abroad, his vision for the USSR, what he was trying to achieve, how that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Berlin Wall and so on, his relationship with Boris Yeltsin, and how all of that fed into Vladimir Putin's Russia and the situation that we see today. So please enjoy this. If you like what you hear and if you want to catch up on the rest of the mini-series, then just search Rest is History 161 Yeltsin and Putin or click on the link in the episode notes. And in the meantime, enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to The Rest is History, and we would like to go over to Crawford, Texas, where we are joined by a special guest.
I'll answer the question. I looked the man in the eye. I found it to be very straightforward and trustworthy. We had a very good dialogue. I was able to get a sense of his soul. He's a man deeply committed to his country and the best interests of his country, and I appreciated so very much the frank dialogue. There was no kind of diplomatic chit-chat trying to throw each other off balance. There was a straightforward dialogue, and that's the beginning of a very constructive relationship. I wouldn't have invited him to my ranch if I didn't trust him.
That was my brilliant impression of George W. Bush. It wasn't actually...
No,
that really was George Bush.
That was George. That was our first presidential guest.
And that was the occasion in 2001 of his first meeting with President Vladimir Putin. In light of the current situation, we thought that it would be interesting to look at some of the historical context. We've already done an episode on the history of Ukraine, but we thought that it would be, you know, I mean, essentially everyone is asking, how did we get here? What is it that's prompted Putin to do what he's doing? You know, what is the background? What is there an explanation for it that can be discovered in history, I suppose, and specifically in his biography? This is a field that you are much, much more familiar with than I am. But I guess I lived through it, so a lot of it.
Yeah. I think, Tom, there's that apocryphal saying by Napoleon, isn't there, that if you know the world, if you study the world when a man was 20, you know how his mind works. And Vladimir Putin, like any Russian of his generation, he's born in 1952, has lived through the most colossal almost unimaginable political, economic, kind of social changes in the former Soviet Union and Russia. And if we, and it's only by understanding what's happened to him and his country, I think, that you can actually get into his, into his, well, attempt to get into his head and to understand why Russia is now as it is. So now it's becoming, you know, it appears to be becoming this pariah state, kind of shut off behind a new iron curtain of sanctions. How on earth has it got here? And that's what we're going to try and investigate.
I mean, Dominic, you're, of course, it's been an absolutely convulsive period of change, but there is also always the historian's question, change or continuity. And you could say, I mean, people have been saying that actually not that much has changed, that the Soviet Union was a political system founded on lies, founded on a profound suspicion of the outside, founded on an emphasis on military prowess over everything else. And you could say that Russia today is showing, you know, much the same.
Is the air of that. Yeah, I don't. Normally, I'm a great determinist in this podcast, but I don't think that's really true, actually. I think that misses, you know, obviously Putin himself is a product of the Soviet system, which we'll go into in a second. But I think when you actually go through the period of change, you see that there were alternative paths that Russia could have taken. And Russia isn't fated to be this sort of violent, you know, nationalistic kind of hellhole that so many people imagine. You know, what happened in the USSR in the 1980s and then in Russia in the 1990s, there are all kinds of contingencies and twists and so on. And there were alternative futures for Russia, as we will see.
But just before we go to look at the last decade of the Soviet Union, you talked about the idea that Russia wasn't fated to become what it is now. But that idea of fate, the idea that Russia has a particular destiny, I mean, that is something that is very strong in Russian culture and actually much older, of course, than communism.
Yeah, the sort of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. Well, I mean, there are two different things, aren't there? Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. But the sort of the idea of Russia having this almost, as you would say, Tom, this almost kind of sacral destiny, you know, the Third Rome, the home of orthodoxy, kind of on the edge of Europe, half in Europe, half out. I mean, that is very deeply rooted in Russia's sense of itself, the sense of embattlement, a distrust of the outside, but also a fascination with it. So, yes, all those things are there. But there is a sort of slightly stereotypical way we talk about Russia. So we always talk about, I mean, even George Bush did it there when he talked about knowing Putin's soul.
Yes.
The idea of the Russians having a soul that you must understand that is incredibly deep and dark. I mean, nobody says that about, you know,
Belgium.
Yeah, Belgium. No, nobody says that about Belgium. Maybe Bart Van Loo, our previous guest, would say that.
But also,
about,
I mean, today, when you apply the word exceptionalism to countries, it's generally a pejorative. So people are very sniffy about the idea that there might be British exceptionalism or French exceptionalism.
Or American
even
exceptionalism.
Though clearly, yeah. You know, I mean, they are all very exceptional countries. But in Russia, it seems to be something that is pretty fundamental to the way that not just Russian politicians, but large numbers of people within the country think of Russia. Would you say that's fair, or am I stereotyping?
I think it probably is fair. I think that's the way that a lot of Russians are told to think about themselves, that they have an exceptional, a unique past and a kind of exceptional destiny. And that we do think of Russia typically as having an exceptional character. Outsiders do. And that's all that stuff about the Russian soul and about, you know, Russians are terribly kind of warm people, but they're also that the price of human life is lower and all that sort of thing that you hear so often. Yes, so I think there is a kind of exceptionalism, both projected from the outside, but also believed inside.
I mean, it was expressed very unsettlingly by Putin, and I may be paraphrasing him here, and I, you know, this may be disinformation, but didn't he say something to the effect, talking with regard to nuclear weapons, that a world without Russia wouldn't be a world? You know, why should the world exist if it exists without Russia?
Yes. And not only has he said that, by the way, but his kind of mouthpieces on Russian state television have used exactly the same line. So that's, a well-worn line, actually, in the sort of Putinist ideology.
Right. Okay. So a bit unsettling coming from people with the largest quantity of nuclear weapons on the face of the planet. But something that, as we said, can be traced back to the Tsarist period, but obviously gets a particular refinement under communism, where what had been the Russian Empire becomes the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And as the Soviet Union is one of two superpowers and sees itself charged with a historical destiny, it is the midwife of world communism. That has sustained it throughout decades of transformation and upheaval. By the 70s, when Putin is coming of age, that sense of purpose and of destiny perhaps is starting to fade. It's the age of Brezhnev, a man with kind of insanely huge eyebrows
and
a kind of rigor mortis starts, isn't it? I mean, they're all kind of basically dead. They are constantly getting colds, but keep them in their beds for 5 years. They wear nothing but overcoats.
They wear things under the overcoats, Tom.
Do they? I've never seen any evidence for that.
yeah, you're right. So
it's always snowing. So what's going on?
So Putin is born in Leningrad, St. Petersburg in 1952, and he's from a working class family. His parents work in a factory. And he goes to Leningrad State University in 1970, I think, and he's there for 5 years. And so he comes of age in the Brezhnev era, as you say. And it's an age of... It is not an age of revolutionary zeal at all. So you mentioned communism and a sort of sense of communist zeal, but that really isn't what typifies the Brezhnev regime. The Brezhnev regime is all about stability, and there's a kind of ordinariness to it. So for most people who are alive in the Soviet Union at that point, the Soviet Union is all they've ever known. And everybody in the world, you know, in America and Britain, in Western Europe and in the Soviet Union, thinks the Soviet Union is going to probably be around forever. You know, it is, as you say, one of the two superpowers. It's sclerotic. The economy is producing enough to keep people happy, so they're fed. They've actually got more consumer goods than ever before. You know, Robert Service, in his History of Russia, says, I think he uses the phrase, most Russian workers had never had it so good as they had it in the 1970s. So they've got fridges, they go on holiday there. You know, life's okay.
But relatively, they've never had it. I mean, they've never had it so good, but relative to the capitalist West.
Of course, it's falling
economically
further.
They're starting to fall behind.
And the prosperity, the apparent prosperity of the 70s is based on a fiction. So it's based on a sclerotic, incredibly complicated, top-down sort of system. You know, the sort of parodies of sort of state planning and tractor statistics and all that stuff. They're all rooted in truth. But it's also rooted in high oil prices. So high world, that they're almost living a bit of an illusion. Because when the oil price falls in the 1980s, that's going to pull the rug out from the system. And Brezhnev, as you say, I mean, he's not Stalin. You know, he's nothing like Stalin. It's still a very autocratic system. It's one that represses dissidents and shoves them into psychiatric hospitals, but it doesn't kill lots of people. So life kind of, you know, goes on. And for a young man like Putin, his ambition is to join the KGB. Supposedly he applies to join and they say to him, well, you don't apply, you know, we contact you, but they kind of make a note of him because they know that he's loyal and hardworking and all this sort of stuff. So for him, he thinks he's joining the intelligence service of one of the world's great power, because the 1970s is a terrible decade for the kind of the United States. It's the decade of Nixon and Carter and Vietnam and this sort of introspection, and the Soviet Union. There's a sort of sense that the Soviet Union might even be winning the Cold War.
Burying them,
as Khrushchev said to Nixon. So there's this sort of false image, I think, that people have about their own society in the 70s. And there are some people at the top of the Soviet regime. So in particular, the man who's going to succeed Brezhnev, who's a man called Yuri Andropov, who is the head of the KGB. There are some people who know that there are deep problems, that Russia has... You know, I say Russia, the Soviet Union has huge problems with alcoholism, with absenteeism, that its birth rate is struggling, that, you know, high rates of corruption, all these kinds of things. But Putin doesn't see this as a young man, I wouldn't have said.
Well, two questions. First of all, Putin, is he a committed communist as a young man, or is he a committed nationalist? What's the balance there?
If you read sort of his semi-official biography, it says that he reads... You know, he enjoys reading Marxist-Leninist books when he's at school. I mean, I think it's a bit like Christianity, Tom.
Is it?
It is, in this sense. There's a difference between being a Christian in the 2nd century AD and being a Christian in the 16th century when everybody's a Christian. And, you know, you're not a radical, you're not a rebel, you're not necessarily...
Well, you might be in the 16th century.
Yeah, but you might not be you might be a good Christian, but none of those things. You might just be an apparatchik. And I think he's a communist in the sense that he's listened to everything he's been told, and that provides his framework. But I don't think he's I don't think he burns with the zeal of social justice or with revolutionary enthusiasm. Okay. Or anything. I think a lot of the people who are running the show don't burn with revolutionary zeal.
Okay, that was my other question. But I think before I ask that, let's take a quick break. You were just saying before the break that a lot of the people at the top of the Soviet Union are not burning with kind of revolutionary communist zeal. And the question I asked you was on Andropov. He's the guy who notoriously has the cold. It lasts for what, kind of 3 years or something? I mean, basically he's incapacitated for the whole period of his term as general secretary.
Yes.
And then he's succeeded by Chernenko, who is kind of in many ways even more moribund. Are these guys people who, so Andropov is a very smart guy. He recognizes the Soviet Union has huge problems. Is he a believer, though? He doesn't question the system. He just thinks that the system needs a bit of tinkering, you know, apply the spanner here, a bit of oil there, and it will tick along fine.
He doesn't question the mission, I suppose, is what I would say. Chernenko, he's a hack. He's just a party hack. Andropov is clever. He was the Soviet ambassador, I think, in Hungary during the Budapest uprising. So he has taken from that a belief that you have to be strong. You know, you have to suppress dissent. You can't let things. But he also has taken a belief that you have to get in ahead. So, you know, you can't let yourself get in a situation where thousands of people are in the streets. You have to keep changing the system to make it work. So I don't think Andropov he's very severe. He's very strict. He's very anti-corruption. And he's clever. And he has read forbidden books. And he, as Soviets, sort of the top brass are allowed to do, they're expected to do, to inform themselves. And he's surrounded himself with aides who are relatively free thinking. But he's still, everybody there believes in them, that their model must triumph. And they believe they're in a global competition with the United States. Absolutely.
Yeah, and so he is, you said he was head of the KGB. He's general secretary during the kind of the coldest days of the Cold War in the early 80s.
Yes.
So he is the guy who's in charge when Reagan is lambasting the Soviet Union as evil empire.
Yeah.
And it's 99 red balloons and two tribes.
Which is very frightening, kind of, by the way, for the Soviet leadership. They think the Americans are going to attack them. Well, we did a podcast about this with Taylor Downing about nuclear war. They absolutely are terrified that the Americans are going to attack them first. But yeah, so Andropov takes over, Brezhnev dies. I mean, Brezhnev basically died multiple times and was literally brought back from the dead. He's sort of resuscitated and dragged around as this sort of embalmed figure in the late 1970s. Andropov succeeds in November 82 and is there till February 84. And as you said, he's basically ill the whole time. I mean, they literally, on one side of his bed, there'll be the man with the nuclear briefcase. And the other side of his bed will be the nurse who's keeping him alive. Mm-hmm. And then he dies. Now, the person he wants to succeed him is the crucial figure in this podcast, and for Putin, a figure of utter ignominy and shame in Russian history, as indeed he is for a lot of Russians. And that man is Mikhail Gorbachev. That's the man that Andropov wants to take over, but he doesn't. He's too young. So the other people in the Politburo, they bypass him and they get this old hack, Chernenko, who is another sort of, he's dying when he takes over. And he's there from February 84 to the spring of 85.
So what was it about Gorbachev that Andropov had seen?
That's a really good question. So Gorbachev is a generation younger. He's the youngest guy, I think, pretty much on the Politburo. He joins in 1980 and he's 49, which is incredibly young by the standards of the Soviet leadership.
And he has a glamorous wife.
He does, Raisa. A very clever wife, who's a very important, hugely important figure for him, his chief advisor, his real soulmate. So Gorbachev is from a place called Stavropol. He's from a little village called, what's it called? Privolnoye, I think it's called. And he's from peasant stock. He's bright. He's super bright. He's gone to Moscow State University, and I think he's read law.
He's got a birthmark on his
on his head. He does indeed. He's traveled, so he's been abroad. He even went on a 3-week driving holiday in France with Raisa. And they sort of drove around France and said, God, this place is so much better than the Soviet Union. This is the sort of classic thing that often happens when people are posted to the West. He actually, one of his chief aides one of his chief advisors is a man called Alexander Yakovlev, who had been ambassador to Canada and basically had exactly the same kind of crisis of confidence. You know, he got to Canada and was like, oh my God, this base is great.
But when Gorbachev becomes general secretary,
yeah,
he's still a believer. I mean, he just because he's got nice camembert in France, it doesn't mean that
absolutely,
he thinks...
Tom. Absolutely, he's a believer. He is idealistic, and this is one of the great problems with Gorbachev. Now, Gorbachev is a fascinating character because, of course, everybody listening to this, by and large, will think, "Oh, Gorby, nice guy, you know, Nobel Peace Prize winner, top man." Of course, in Russia, he is regarded with absolute contempt. And I have to say, when you start to dig into the story and you think about Gorbachev in a slightly more detached way. I mean, we've done a lot of weak and failed leaders on this podcast. And although it pains me to say it because he's an admirable man in so many ways. I mean, but when he leaves office, he's only in there for 6 years. And when he leaves, his country has completely and utterly fallen apart. Now, some people would say that's because the problems are too great. But I think Gorbachev, I think almost all historians actually who really work on this, people like Robert Service or Vladislav Zubok, who wrote a brilliant book called Collapse, that came out last year, The Fall of the Soviet Union, they would just say Gorbachev is a complete and utter disaster.
Why?
He's idealistic, Tom. He's bright. He and Raisa have spent loads of time talking about the future of the Soviet Union. They like talking to other kind of intellectually kind of people. Gorbachev is also very canny. So he's been able to get up the kind of greasy pole. He's powerful patrons like Andropov think a lot of him. He says to Raisa when he joins the, I think it's when he joined the Politburo, he said, we can't live like this any longer. And he's determined to fix the system. But he goes about fixing it in such a politically incompetent. I mean, it slightly pains me to say it, but he fixes it in such an inept way that absolutely everything gets worse. He does too much, too quickly, too many different areas, and everything falls apart. And you said, what, is he a believer? He's absolutely a believer. So Vladislav Zubok brings this out really well in his book. He says, you know, Gorbachev is obsessed with Lenin. I mean, this is so much like your parallel with your Christianity stuff about people who, you know, people who would kind of, Oliver Cromwell or somebody, reading the Bible to guide mm-hmm. them. Gorbachev has Lenin's sort of works on his desk, and he will sort of dip into them in the way that people sometimes dip into the Bible. He will dip into them to try and get inspiration for what he needs to do. And he is convinced that the Soviet Union has taken a wrong turn since the 1920s, and it needs to get back to Lenin's vision. He idealizes Lenin, and he thinks Lenin had a vision. It's a more democratic, free, open, creative. And if I can get back to that, we'll establish true communism, and then we'll turn this sort of sinking ship around, if you can turn a sinking ship around.
So that's quite a kind of abstract sense of mission. But maybe I've got this wrong, but I thought that he was also focused on a very specific problem, which was that the Soviet economy was massively distorted by defense spending. So they're spending, what, 20, 25%?
No, it's probably not. That's actually been exaggerated. It's about 15%, I think, is the latest
estimate.
But still
quite a lot.
It is, but it's...
If they're going to, you know, guns to butter,
yeah,
then they need to make things up with the West. So he does that very effectively. I mean, he's very good at that.
Yes.
He definitely kind of removes the chill from the Cold War very effectively. So, which is why people in the West, you know, rate him so highly. But as someone who is ideologically committed to Marxist-Leninism, I mean, isn't it a definition of the job that kind of trying to construct an economy that will provide Soviet citizens with all the kind of consumer durables and gizmos that you get in the West is bound to fail? I mean, there's just no way it can be done.
No, I don't agree with that. I actually don't agree with either of those things. So first of all, the defense spending, that has become a very comforting myth that the West tells itself about the Soviet Union, particularly in America, that we won the Cold War by increasing defense spending so much that they couldn't keep up. But most historians, I think, would now say they could keep up. I mean, they have
with defense spending.
Yeah, they've done it since the 40s. They could have carried on doing it. I mean, that defense spending is not what brings the Soviet Union down. Second point, I've forgotten what your second point was, Tom. Consumer durables. Well, there is a very good example of a communist country that has, you know, embraced a consumer economy.
China.
And that's China. And the Chinese, I mean, Deng Xiaoping supposedly said something to the effect of his son asked him what he thought of Gorbachev, and he said, I think Gorbachev's a complete idiot.
Yes, but this is communism with Chinese characteristics, which basically means a kind of freedom to ignore aspects of communism that don't gel with making money. But Leninism absolutely did. I mean, Leninism was all about kind of collectivization.
But Tom,
all
I think
about
most
suppression of private enterprise.
But I think most historians would say, well, first of all, that's not what Gorbachev himself thinks. He thinks Lenin's new economic policy in the 1920s after the Russian Civil War did allow some space for limited private enterprise and that they can move towards a mixed economy. I think one of the big problems with the Soviet Union is it's become so reliant on imports paid for with oil revenue, and it's completely failed to develop its own kind of consumer industries.
Okay. So it's like Saudi Arabia with snow. A bit.
Is that what the Saudis, what do? Do they spend their raw money on snow?
No, but I mean, it's the Saudi, you know, it's notoriously economies that have lots of oil tend to be dysfunctional.
Well, yes, Iran is a good example from the 70s. We talked about Iran a lot in previous podcasts. And I think, yes, it's incredibly dysfunctional. I mean, it's unbelievably complicated economy. When Gorbachev is given, they're talking about this thing called the law of state enterprise, which is going to be this law that's going to allow a little bit of more freedom for factories to keep their money and to invest it and that sort of thing. Gorbachev says at one point, you know, I basically don't understand this. And nobody really understands.
I feel sympathy. He's trying to mend a machine for which there is no instruction manual.
I think there's a degree of that. But I think he's also, you see, the thing is, he's trying to mend this machine, which has incredibly complicated kind of supply chain networks and it has this weird cashless system that enterprises use with each other, whereas citizens use cash and you can't change one to the other. I mean, it's completely mad, but that's the way. It's a bit like any massive sclerotic institution. Once you start to fiddle with it, it becomes very difficult to stop it from falling apart. But the other thing is he combines this with a – so he has the perestroika, which is restructuring, which kind of has political and economic developments, but he combines it with glasnost, which is openness. Yes. And that's in the wake of Chernobyl. So Chernobyl, the explosion at Chernobyl is in April 1986. And after that, Gorbachev thinks, well, I need to increase the speed. We need to have more newspapers. We need to have more discussion.
And why is it? Why does Chernobyl have that effect on him?
Because I think he's shocked by the incompetence, by the cover-ups, by the ineptitude of the managers, by the way the atomic industry has been run, by their lies, all of that kind of stuff. You know, Gorbachev, of course, he's complicit in covering it up a bit because he's the general secretary and he kind of feels like he has to, but he still thinks, okay, we need to, you know, we just need to be more open and we need to be more creative. Crucially, one of the things he does now, one of the things we haven't talked about at all, which is very important for understanding Putin, is the Soviet Union, and I know we have a lot of very kind of, to us, young listeners, the Soviet Union is not anything like a nation state. And it doesn't even really see itself as an empire. So it's got 15 republics going all the way from Estonia. I mean, it's a mad state in many ways. It's existed, you know, one form or another since the 20s, but it's got going all the way from Estonia to kind of Tajikistan. And the Russians are roughly about 50% of that, you know, the Russian population. And there has always been the issue of nationalism. You know, there's always been tensions in the Caucasus, in Central Asia, in the Baltics, and so on. And Gorbachev has this idea that by basically devolving a lot of power to the republics, I mean, devolution, Tom, what could possibly go wrong? Mm-hmm. Devolving power to the republics, that will invigorate the system. You know, but at the same time, he wants to open everything up so people can debate things more freely. So that will obviously give nationalism more room to sort of to flourish. Yeah. But he also combines that with an attack on what he sees as the corruption of the old elites. So the old elites are embattled. People are talking about new ideas, but they're also being given more power. The whole thing, it's a sort of, he creates unwittingly a kind of breeding ground for all these kind of nationalistic movements to thrive. And you see it as early as 1986. You see it in Kazakhstan and in the Baltics and in Ukraine. Movements calling for new language rights and, you know, opposing power stations and all these kinds of things. So the seeds of trouble are there even after he's only been there a year.
And Dominic, do we know what Putin is doing?
Yes,
during this
we
time?
Do. So this
he's
is
in St. Petersburg still?
No. No, this is the interesting thing. He's not. So around about the point where Chernenko gave way to Gorbachev, where Gorbachev came into power, Vladimir Putin has been working for the KGB since the late 70s, and he has now been posted to Dresden in East Germany.
Oh, of course he has. Yes, of course.
So what he's doing, and he's doing sort of slightly, it seems, there are different stories. Some people say he's just compiling information about dissidents. Some people say actually he's trying to sort of forge links with the sort of remnants of the Red Army faction, the Baader-Meinhof gang in West Germany. We don't know because, of course, it's secret. But what we know is he's watching all this from outside. So he has left a state that he thinks is powerful, you know, strong, respected in the world, high status. And he sees this guy trying to reform it, to change things. And that's really important, I think, that Putin is watching it from outside and he's watching it, frankly, with horror.
And he's in East Germany, which has a higher standard of living relative to the Soviet Union.
It does indeed, yes.
So he is alert to, presumably, some of the problems that the Soviet economy faces.
Yes. I don't think you asked if Putin was a communist. He's certainly not a communist now and has not been since the fall of the USSR. But what he is a believer in the Russian world, in the Russian sphere of influence. And I think that's what's going to trouble him as we get into the late 80s and early 90s, that starts to fragment and fall apart.
Well, I think that's enough for today. So that's the end of today's episode. Please join us tomorrow to hear about when things really start imploding for Gorbachev in the late 80s and in due course for the Soviet Union itself. We will see you tomorrow. How are things basically on the ground in the USSR at this point? Is there a sense of optimism, of enthusiasm, or just kind of disinterest, or what's the mood?
So they're not going well. So Gorbachev is, I mean, this is such an immensely complicated story. And I'm trying to sort of simplify it as much as possible. So Gorbachev is slightly torn between two different camps. He has the reformers who want him to go further, faster. And he has...
And the leading reformer, is Boris Yeltsin, taken on that mantle by this point? Should we talk about him?
We can introduce Boris Yeltsin now. Now, we're going to do Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s in a subsequent podcast because it's such a complicated and huge story. And this is an absolutely fascinating thing because the relationship between these two men, I mean, this really is an example of individuals mattering in history, Tom, because I think the relationship
which
between...
Which is so ironic, isn't it, in the context
it
of,
is,
in the context of the Soviet Union.
The relationship between these two men and the way they don't get along is so crucial to this story. Had they got along, the Soviet Union might well still exist. And the war in Ukraine would not now be happening.
Well, so he's brought in by Gorbachev to be basically what? The kind of to run Moscow.
Exactly. He's been in a place called Sverdlovsk, which was called Sverdlovsk at the time, but it's Ekaterinburg. So it's the place where the Romanovs were executed in the Urals. Now, Yeltsin is a very different character from Gorbachev. Gorbachev is more idealistic and a kind of reader and all that sort of stuff, and a committee man, a man who loves tinkering with constitutions. Yeltsin is, as we all know, he's ebullient. He's a populist. He likes a drink. He's great at glad-handing the crowds. He can be a bit of a clab. He can be a bully. He's this larger-than-life, kind of incredibly impulsive figure. Yeltsin wants them to go faster. In 1987, so actually round about the time they're celebrating the anniversary of the October Revolution, Yeltsin says, I've had enough. He's been attacked. He's very sort of sensitive, Yeltsin. So he's been attacked by hardliners, and he becomes the first person ever to resign from the Politburo. Mm-hmm. And Gorbachev is absolutely outraged by this, thinks this is terrible. And there's this sort of campaign against Yeltsin. Yeltsin, and this is not a story that's lost people in the West, I think, as familiar with as they should be. Yeltsin tries to kill himself by stabbing himself in the chest with some scissors. He's taken to hospital. And basically, when he's in hospital, being pumped full of drugs, because people say he's gone mad and had a nervous breakdown, Gorbachev says, you have to come to a party meeting, a Moscow party meeting, to be ritually humiliated.
This is so Dostoevsky, isn't it?
And he is. I mean, they pump him full of drugs. He comes out of hospital and he has to sit there while everybody else says, Boris Nikolaevich, you know, you're a capitalist running dog or whatever they're saying. And he has to take it and he never forgives Gorbachev.
It's like the brothers Karamazov or something.
It is. I mean, it is. And he's determined, of course, to get his revenge. And that plays such a big part. Yeltsin feels completely and utterly humiliated. So
he's out of the Politburo.
Yeah, but he's not being kicked out of politics.
The Communist Party.
So he's still lurking around. Yes, exactly. He's still in the Communist Party. He's still sort of drifting around in in political life. Now, the economic reforms are not going well at all. So you get the queues. They've always been queues, but they're getting longer and longer. There are shortages in the shops. There's also more and more problems in the other republics, kind of demonstrations and all this sort of stuff.
And Dominic, is this both with Perestroika, so the reorganization, and Glasnost opening, is this because Gorbachev by 87, 88 is essentially, he's reached a kind of halfway house where he doesn't have the benefits of either?
Exactly,
system.
Tom. Exactly. I mean, how often have you seen this with kind of Roman emperors or with kings or medieval kings that you have to choose. And Gorbachev thinks I have to keep my sort of foot in both camps. He also, to his credit in some ways, he doesn't believe in violence. I mean, he very rarely, there are examples in Georgia and most famously in Lithuania, where he uses troops to kind of repress uprisings. But by and large, he doesn't like doing it. And there are some historians, I mentioned Vladislav Zubok, who basically imply if he'd been tougher, more ruthless, if he'd accumulated more power instead of giving it away, and he'd been quicker to use the sort of forces of law and order.
He didn't do it, but he should have done it.
Well, that's
a paraphrase, a leading historian.
That's,
right.
Murder of the Princes. He should have been more Richard III.
Yeah.
But what Gorbachev does is he's been blocked and he says, well, the way to do it is to have even more democracy. So he has this massive thing called the Congress of People's Deputies, which he launches the plans for in the summer of 88.
Is this akin to Charles I summoning a parliament back after the years of personal rule, or Louis XVI summoning people to...
The States General.
The States General to...
Yeah. It has a bit of that, I suppose. I mean, the Congress of People's Deputies is absolutely enormous. They're going to have like 2,250 members. And from that will choose a Supreme Soviet. And he will also be personally elected for the first time as president, not as general secretary. So it's a way of kind of bypassing the party.
It is, but it's properly democratic, right? I mean, there's a proper democratic element in a system that hasn't had a democratic element like that for
exactly.
a very, very long time.
So dissidents are elected. There are kind of nationalist figures from the Baltic states. There are people like Andrei Sakharov, the dissident scientist, very famous kind of figure in the West at this point.
And there's Yeltsin.
Exactly. So. But Tom, what happens is it's also on telly. TV. And this is the first time this has ever happened. And the BBC did a brilliant documentary about this many years ago. I can't for the life of me remember what it's called. And you can only see it on sort of very obscure websites because it was a brilliant kind of five. If you like TV series about committees, this is the one for you.
Right.
So it's a sort of documentary and they have all the sort of the footage. And it's basically people arguing. On platforms, people standing up in the podium and saying, you know, we don't have enough food, or this is a shambles. Boris is right about this. The general secretary is right about that. People never
1789, isn't it?
People never did that.
There is an element of that.
Yeah, there is. I think there probably is. People never did that. And it contributes to this sense of, I think for a lot of Soviet citizens, just confusion. You know, what's going on? People arguing. Some people are delighted by the openness, but a lot of people are just confused by it. And of course, what makes it more toxic is that it's against the background of this, you know, the system now has broken, the interfering with the economic system has contributed to a situation where in 1989, in most parts of Russia, you now actually have meat rationing. There is no sugar. The factories, the fields and the collectives, they're no longer supplying the shops in the cities with what they need.
But against that, by this point, you can read the Gulag Archipelago, can you not?
You can indeed. Yeah, you can.
So this is the great
dissident
work by Solzhenitsyn.
By Solzhenitsyn. But of course, a lot of people don't. This is the thing with
I know, of course they don't want to read it. I mean, you'd rather have a steak or something.
Yeah, they'd rather have some meat. But also, Tom, a lot of people, if you've been brought up to think one way all this time, and then you're suddenly told, well, what you thought was a lie, you know, I mean, there's a very famous article published in 1988, which causes a huge hullabaloo by a woman called Nina Andreeva, very well known to kind of Soviet historians, where she basically says, stop attacking Stalin.
Stalin, right? So
you
said
lying about our history. This kind of, you know, these wokists tearing down statues.
yes. Because you said that for Gorbachev, it's all about Lenin.
Yeah.
And so therefore, Stalin is cast as essentially
the
baddie, the guy who had come in and ruined it. You know, real communism hasn't been tried.
Idea that, you know, what we've been living has been a bit of a lie and we've taken a wrong turn and we need to a lot of people are just really, they're offended and upset and disturbed by that. They don't want to hear it. And of course, it's easier to hear that when you can have some sugar. If there's no tea, no milk. I mean, what is it? 1989, 1990. In Moscow that winter, there is no milk, no tea, no coffee, no soap. Meat is rationed. You need to get to the shop at kind of when it opens. All of this. And against that background, people think, well, this is all going horribly wrong. So that's why, by the way, when the Berlin Wall falls and the Eastern Europe, why there's so little Russian reaction, partly because Gorbachev doesn't believe in using force. It's partly because he's idealistic and he thinks, well, they'll stay in the socialist camp because it's obviously a nicer kind of, kinder, more touchy-feely camp than the capitalist West. It's also because he and the others are so absorbed with their own colossal, colossal problems.
And where is Putin?
So Putin is still in Dresden. Putin is famously in Dresden. Okay. He burns his files, supposedly, when the Berlin Wall falls. He says to somebody, you know, we need to do something. And the guy says, well, we can't do anything without orders from Moscow. And he says some line, what is it? He says, Moscow is silent or something like Moscow says nothing. You know, and for Putin, he later on says of he says, supposedly after he becomes president, he says to some of his men, Russian history has produced two really bad, incompetent leaders. They were Nicholas II and Mikhail Sergeyevich Gorbachev, because they were weak. They were weaklings.
Whereas his two great heroes are Peter the Great and Stalin.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that tells you all you need to know. Mm. Basically, don't rent your house out to Vladimir Putin, as we discovered in our parties podcast, because he'd smash it up, as like he's smashing up Ukraine. Right. So we're into 1990 now, Tom.
So the Warsaw Pact basically has drifted off.
Has drifted off. Russia is moving towards this, the Soviet Union is moving towards this kind of multi-party politics. Industry is in a state of collapse. A lot of Gorbachev's sort of more reform-minded allies have deserted him because they think he's not going fast enough. But crucially, what's happening now is that the party elites and the people who run the state enterprises in the different republics are now beginning to think, you know, I don't want Gorbachev in a sort of shambolic interference in my affairs, and maybe I should be riding the tiger of kind of nationalism. So you start to see, I mean, obviously you get the upsurge of nationalism in the Baltic states because they remember, you know, that they were basically snatched by Stalin and they want their freedom. But in other republics now, the nationalism is becoming more and more of a thing.
And also within Russia itself.
And also, well, this is the fascinating thing. Boris Yeltsin has becomes in the spring of 1990, he becomes the elected leader of Russia. So Russia is 50%+ of the Soviet population. And like a lot of these republics, they're starting to declare their own sovereignty. They're saying, well, we are actually sovereign. We're not just kind of provinces of a Soviet system. We have our own, you know, our own personality, our own kind of legal, we're legal entities in our own right. So Yeltsin, basically reformer, he's capitalizing on people's frustration at the queues and stuff and their frustration with corruption and all these kinds of things. Yeltsin basically establishes Russia as a counterweight to the Soviet Union. So for the first time, you get the sense, I think, 1990, 91, of almost kind of parallel governments. They're competing for advisors. They can have different economic programs, all of this kind of stuff.
And there's a lightning rod for that, isn't there, in Vilnius?
Yeah. So Vilnius is when he does use violence. That's the exception.
Gorbachev does.
So
and Yeltsin opposes it. And Yeltsin basically says to the Russian troops in the Baltic states, don't use violence.
Yeah. So I think Yeltsin is much more of a kind of let them go. Gorbachev is torn. He believes in the Soviet Union. He doesn't want to see anybody leave the Soviet Union. He hates violence, but he's persuaded to use troops against the TV station in Vilnius, and they kill 15 people. And it's against that kind of background. So you've got economic meltdown. You have a sort of loss of political authority. You have the sort of the public bewildered and stuff that Gorbachev says, well, listen, I mean, he's messed around with the constitution so much already. But he says, you know, a new change. We're going to have a new union treaty. So replacing kind of 1922, which we talked about in our 1922 podcast at the beginning of the year. We're going to have a new union treaty, and that'll be signed in August. All the republics will sign it, and it's basically signing up to a new model, slightly more decentralized model of the Soviet Union. Kind of, it's like we're reaffirming our vows, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's against the background. In that summer, there is a total kind of collapse in the economy. So industry collapses by 18%, agriculture by 17%. They're running a massive deficit now. They can't afford to import consumer goods. At that point, there is a road not taken, which you sometimes hear talk about in the West. So there is talk in the summer of 1991 of George Bush Sr.'s administration intervening with a kind of Marshall Plan for the Soviet Union. And I think there is a case that this is a great what if. Because there's a
so
guy.
What would have happened?
Well, there's a guy called Grigory Yavlinsky, who's a Russian reformer, and he cooks up a scheme with a Harvard academic called Graham Allison, and that's basically to lend the Soviet Union billions, or to give the Soviet Union billions of dollars, and establish them as a partner, so that Gorbachev to basically bail Gorbachev out. And Bush says no, Congress won't back it. We're not in the business of flushing money down the drain, which is what will happen. You know, the Soviet Union is a communist country. What are we doing? All this kind of stuff. They don't do it. What would have happened? Who can say, Tom? I mean, maybe I think Gorbachev had lost so much political authority by that point already that actually that would have been money down the drain brutally.
Yeah.
Certainly wouldn't have saved. I don't think it would have saved Gorbachev. Probably wouldn't. Might not have saved the Soviet Union either. But it might have cushioned Russia's transition to democracy.
Okay, let's take a quick break there, and we will see you after some ads, or not after some ads, if you are members of the Rest is History Club. Whatever format you're listening, we will be back with you very soon. Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History. Gorbachev is struggling to keep the Soviet Union together. Does Yeltsin have a feeling it would be better for Russia to get rid of all these kind of various deadbeats, as he sees them, these appendages to Mother Russia? Is that his attitude?
Some people may think, listening to this, may think, gosh, this has got a bit of kind of a United Kingdom sort of arguments about devolution and Scottish or Welsh independence kind of vibe to it. Because definitely there are people now in Russia for the first time who are sort of saying, do we need all these Islamic republics in Central Asia? You know, they're just... The problem, though, is that 25 million Russian speakers live outside Russia. I mean, that's the context for the world we're living in now. That it's a bit like, you know, Germany. Yeah. We'll get into this in the next podcast about the Weimar Republic parallels, but that is a problem. But Yeltsin is, I think Yeltsin, the sense I get from a lot of the books on this is that Yeltsin is completely fixated on his rivalry with Gorbachev. And he's not thinking kind of particularly strategically about Russia's future in the next 20 or 30 years. He's thinking, how can I establish myself as the sort of primus inter pares instead of Gorbachev?
But Dominic, it's not just Gorbachev against Yeltsin, is it? Because there are also lurking in the background communist hardliners.
Yeah.
And in August 1991, they launch basically an incredibly incompetent coup.
Yeah.
But I remember walking through London and seeing a kind of newspaper billboard saying coup in Moscow and thinking, oh, God.
Yeah.
Again, because a bit like the headlines at the moment, this was a headline that could have come from an alternative reality novel in which, you know, the world gets blown up or something. So I'm being very nervous.
I'm a bit younger than you. My mum woke me up to tell me the news sort of first thing in the morning.
So that was Gorbachev being arrested in his dacha, wasn't it?
Yeah, he'd gone to Foros in the Crimea where he went on holiday. And one day, so it's 2 days actually before they're going to sign the new union treaty. And the hardliners think this will give away so much power forever and we'll never get it back. So they cut off his telephones, they pitch up, they kind of basically want him to resign. He doesn't want to do it. They form a state emergency committee. As you say, it's a complete shambles. They don't arrest Yeltsin. They don't take control of communications. They don't take control of the Russian streets. And Yeltsin has his moment in history. I mean, they've handed it to him on a platter and he seizes it with this, because we said before he was an ebullient populist character. I mean, anyone who lived through this will remember those incredible scenes. You know, Yeltsin gets on a tank. He commandeers a tank. There's amazing photos. The tank driver's got his head in his hands. Because, you know, he's basically been humiliated. Yeltsin has seized his tank. It's a great crowd around him. He reads a proclamation in which he says, you know, this is a coup of reactionaries and all this. He takes possession of the Russian Parliament building, not the Soviet, not the building of the, you know, the of the, and the Kremlin, but a building called the White House, ironically, the Russian Parliament. And for a couple of days, it looks like the coup plotters are going to storm the White House and kill Yeltsin, but they don't have the guts. They're all absolutely hammered or shaking or just sort of sweating and gibbering in their various offices. They don't have a plan. They don't have a
heavy uniform.
They're actually, if you look at the footage, I always remember the footage. The leader was a guy called Gennady Yanayev, and he was shaking when he read, well, he was the front man. He wasn't the leader. He was shaking when he read his proclamation. They're all wearing the most terrible suits. I mean, those suits in themselves are a very bad advert for the Soviet system. Supposedly, this is the moment when Putin resigned from the KGB. I mean, I say resigned. I mean, there's a question about whether he ever left the KGB. But later in his as it were, official biography, it was claimed that this was the point where he broke with communism, Putin. But I mean, whether that's true, none of us can.
To side with Yeltsin?
Yes. Well, we'll get into how Putin and Yeltsin form their relationship in the next podcast. But yes, it's just impossible to say what Putin's position on all this is. I mean, my sense is
but he's not there at the White House with Yeltsin on the tank.
No. I mean,
he's watching from the distance.
Yes, he is watching from a distance. So, okay, right. Gorbachev, the coup plotters lose their nerve. Gorbachev returns from the Crimea. And then we talked about the humiliation for Yeltsin. Now it's his turn, his chance to turn the tables. And, you know, again, incredible that this was played out live on television. He basically gets Gorbachev to a meeting of the Russian Supreme Soviet, basically the government that Yeltsin controls, and he says, you know, live in front of, he says, here's a list of all the people, your aides, your appointees who collaborated in the coup, read it out. And he makes Gorbachev read it out in front of this audience, terribly humiliating. And then Yeltsin just suddenly has the momentum. He bans the Communist Party in Russia. He says, we're going to move to a market economy, you know, immediately. We're going to have, you know, shock therapies looming. Nobody knows what that means at this point. But he says, you know, I have the economic sort of medicine that will fix the what's gone wrong.
The alternative.
Yes, very Thatcherite. But at the same time, this is the point when the various republics start to go their own way. So Yeltsin says, yeah, fine, let the Baltic states go. The real question is Ukraine. So the leader in Ukraine, a man called Leonid Kravchuk, is the classic example of somebody who all his life has just been a complete apparatchik. And now, he wants to hold on to his power. He wants to hold on to the control with his mates of the state enterprises and stuff. And so he jumps onto the Ukrainian nationalist bandwagon. He declares Ukrainian sovereignty, and he declares a referendum for the 1st of December 1991. Why does he do this? The answer is, I think, because he looks at those two people, Gorbachev and Yeltsin, and you think if Gorbachev wins, Gorbachev will sort of, you know, Kravchuk had equivocated during the coup. He thinks if Gorbachev wins, Gorbachev will basically, you know, it's not good for us. He'll mess with us and our system and our privileges and stuff and our control of all this stuff. If Yeltsin, you know, I don't want to be stuck with Yeltsin commandeering it for Russia and sort of, you know, him taking it over. So the best thing is basically we take it over ourselves and we'll control it ourselves. And I think a lot of if you look at the first post-independence leaders in all those Soviet republics in Central Asia and so on, they're all the people generally who are running the Communist Party in those places beforehand.
And the same thing happens in Belarus, right?
Exactly.
And Yeltsin and the Belarus and Ukrainian leaders all meet up in a
wood
hunting lodge.
Yeah, in a forest. Yeah,
in the forest in Belarus.
Yes, so they go to a place called Belavezha. As you know, Tom, I've been to Belarus myself.
Yes, great admirer of its chocolate.
So they meet up, and they basically the leaders of these three republics behind Gorbachev's back. They sign a deal. They'll all become independent. They have a very loose association called the Commonwealth of Independent States, and you know that's it. Bang goes the Soviet Union. Nobody in the Soviet Union, by and large, well, 20% of the people in the Soviet Union want this. 80% do not want this. So this is not happening as a result of massive public protests. It's not happening because after years of, you know, mounting sort of passions and street violence. It's happening largely because of rivalries and desire for self-protection among different parts of the Soviet elite.
Well, we talked about the collapse of the Roman Empire and the way that it, you know, in the West, in the 5th century, chunks of it start splitting off because local bigwigs start to appreciate that they're likely to have more authority, more wealth, more position if they go independent. And you're essentially saying it's much the same thing is happening in the Soviet Union.
It is actually a remarkably...
Barons carving up territory.
It is barons carving up territory. Interestingly, I was just reading this book today, the Zubok book, Collapse. He says he has stuff in that I'd not seen before. There are people around Yeltsin who say to him that December 1991, are you just going to go and say yes to the Ukrainian guy? What about Crimea? What about Donbass? I mean, they literally say these places. And he says, I may mention it, yeah. And he doesn't mention it because he's just so keen to get one over on Gorbachev.
And that's the reason, not because he's drunk.
Well, there is a bit of drinking. there definitely is a bit of drinking. And actually, at that meeting, I think there was some talk of Yeltsin having
it carried out.
Yeah, not having to be carried out. But yeah, it's easy to stereotype Yeltsin. I mean, Yeltsin is a tremendous politician as a populist, as a communicator and stuff. And he has had this sort of very stressful time. And he has been very brave. But you're right. There is always the issue of the drink. He's so fixated, I think, on beating Gorbachev. So they get back.
It's such an amazing psychodrama. And
it is, actually.
Someone should write a film or a play about it. And the
fate of hundreds of millions of people hangs on this. They get back. They get back to Moscow, and they're basically, Gorbachev's like, what? And they say, yeah, the Soviet Union is no more. We've decided to leave. And then, of course, everybody else decides to leave as well. And they say, we'll join this new Commonwealth of Independent States.
Well, the cool kids have moved on.
Basically, Gorbachev is there in the Kremlin. No one listens to him. The army have stopped listening to him. The interior ministry troops don't listen to him. The police don't listen
to him. It's like Romulus Augustulus.
It is exactly that, Tom. We did this story on the 12 Days of Christmas podcast on the 25th of December, 1991. That's the day that Gorbachev resigns as president of the USSR, that the flag comes down, the hammer and sickle, and it's replaced by the Russian tricolor on the sort of Kremlin flagpole. That's the day the Soviet Union ends and the Russian Federation comes into existence. And we did this on our 12 Days of History podcast. But the worst thing about it is not actually the well-known fact that Gorbachev was filmed by American cameramen and he had to borrow a pen from the CNN producer to sign his resignation. A capitalist pen. There's actually a worse fact than that, which I didn't mention on that last podcast, which is that there's a ceremony where he basically hands over the nuclear briefcase to Boris Yeltsin, or gives it to somebody to give to Yeltsin. But actually, in secret, they'd already switched the briefcases. So Gorbachev thought at the end of that he was walking around with the nuclear briefcase, but he wasn't. It had been taken away from him behind his back already.
Don't piss off the cool guys.
And so to go back to Putin, Putin is back in Russia. He watches this with horror. For him, as he later says, the collapse of the Soviet Union, he's called it the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century. And it is an extraordinary moment because at a stroke, the empire that had been inherited by the communists from the czars fragments. The 15 republics go their own way. Suddenly, there is this nation state called Russia that has 88 different federal subjects in it. So it has lots of Muslims. It has Chechens, Tatars, Tuvans, all kinds of people in the kind of in the steppes and the forests of the east, and suddenly it's a nation state that feels like it's lost a colossal amount of status,
and also has lots of its citizens outside its borders.
Lots of people who maybe either think they're Russian or speak Russian. Exactly.
Okay. Well, so what a dramatic moment! The Soviet Union has come to an end. Russia has been born. Yeltsin has replaced Gorbachev. Putin is kind of swimming in the shallows like a kind of baby shark waiting to taste a bit more blood. And I think we should leave it there. And tomorrow's episode, we should see what happens under Yeltsin and how it is that Putin ends up becoming president. See you again tomorrow. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.